Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads. Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead of the game. Coming up on the program today, Africa hosts its first U20 Sherpa meeting. Can urban planning finally deliver shared progress? Climate change threatening to cut South Africa's food production in half by 2050. The illicit tobacco trade is still burning holes in our economy. Can it be stopped? And a tax survival guide for sole proprietors. Don't file blind. It's Thursday, the 12th of June. For the first time on African soil, the U20 Sherpa meeting is now setting the stage for new conversations on how cities drive inclusive economic growth. With leaders gathering in Tshwane and here in Johannesburg, I guess the big question is, can urban collaboration deliver real results, or is this just another summit with lofty statements? Let's try and answer those two questions. I'm joined now by Musa Khumalo, who is Chief Governance and Support Officer at the City of Tshwane. And Musa, very warm welcome to you. So how does this Sherpa meeting translate into actual urban reforms on the ground? Can it achieve that?
Yes, of course, that is always a challenge, is how we turn these events not just to be talk shop, but for it to translate into actions. And South Africa, having taken presidency of the G20, it gives us an opportunity for us, one, to determine the agenda on our side, but obviously that flows into U20, which is more of the engagement at Sherpa level. So it's less of a political engagement and it's more of a technical and so on. So we've tried as much as possible then to ensure that the side events in the U20 are more practical. They relate to things that are challenges that the cities face. But also we deal with the issues of what has stopped the projects that we speak about in events from being implemented. So we're touching on issues of how we empower cities to have proper business cases of the things that we're speaking about, dealing with the issues of funding, which sometimes is a key issue that becomes a problem, that you have very good ideas, but you don't have funding, and then it just remains good on paper and is not implemented. So we've structured the event in a way that it deals with some of the chronic problems that have made these things chalk shops before. And we hope that then with the way we've structured the agenda, it's going to lead to a more practical implementation.
What would you like to see then as a measurable takeaway, a concrete win, in other words?
I think one is that obvious. We've gone beyond just including the metros in this. We've also included the smaller municipalities that are going to be able to participate through SALCA. So we will want them at their level as well to be able to walk away with practical business plans that they will be able to draft out of the discussions here. So, for example, if you take the Smart City event, there are four critical issues that we want to focus on. It's the issues of smart waste, it's the issues of safe city, and so on. So what we want them to take out of here is the ability for them to translate those into bankable business proposals, participate in the funding stream so that they can see what are the funding opportunities that are there, so that part of this then becomes us taking into the market those bankable proposals that can be funded. So what I'll really be happy with is that we walk out of here with the ability for us to have proper fundable business plans and initiatives that will then translate into what we can implement in the coming financial years.
And in your opinion, what would make a good decision in that respect in achieving a scalable and fundable business?
I think the smart city initiatives must respond to the challenges on the ground. I think part of what we've been excited with, it has been just around using technology or buying technology and thinking technology will solve all the problems. So I think what we're looking at is that whatever that we're proposing as city, it must respond to the real challenges. So we need to all think around how what are the practical solutions, for example, within safe cities that can make our cities safer so that we respond to challenges. It's not just about dreaming about having drones and all these technologies, but we talk about things that help us to make cities run better, that makes people to be safe, that can protect the environments in which people live, that people can have sustainable water and electricity, because that is what people are looking for. They're looking for the basic services. So we need to be able to translate all these ideas to be very simple and respond to the challenges that people face on the ground. Otherwise, all the discussions that we have in these conferences, people can't relate to. Because then people hear that you're speaking about smart cities and so on. And when they don't have water, when they don't have electricity today, it becomes very difficult for them to connect to what you're doing. So we need to find ways in which we make our conversations to be practical and to directly link to the challenges that people face on a day-to-day basis.
What type of funding commitments have been realized so far to back this urban vision that you've been discussing?
So we've had commitments, for example, in doing our smart city strategy as the city of Tshwane. We had very good support from the National Treasury, the World Bank, as well as DBSA, who've really supported our journey. And we're getting to that process where so one was them supporting our effort with the aspects that have helped us to draft the strategies. But also, as I said, now to get the projects to be ready for the market so that when we take them out to the market, they're bankable and as well they're properly backed by feasibility studies and so on, because that's what funders are looking for. So that is the support that we've had. And hopefully now as we take the projects into the market, the issue of funding will be sorted. But what also the engagements that we've had with the World Bank and the DBSA has shown is the need for involvement of the private sector, because some of these projects are not going to be funded by government. We know our government is struggling with the funding. So the issue of the need of the private sector to come on board. So you'll know, for example, in the city of Joburg, when you come to safe city and the extent of the CCTV network and modern cameras, part of that has been led by private sector. So not all these things will need to be done by government. And when we're talking about funding, it's not just getting loans and so on, but it's also exploring triple Ps and the engagement of the private funding.
Just a final one. I understand the private sector dynamic, but given often the increased urban decay, surely it becomes difficult to convince the private sector to become involved in initiatives like this.
Yeah, it is difficult, but we're going to have to come together to make things work. At the end of the day, if things don't work in the city of Tshwane, they affect private as well. So crime affect big industries. We have big industries here, for example, your Ford, your BMW, and so on. And yes, government needs to take the responsibility to make things work. That is the primary responsibility of government. But what we're saying is that if the city is decaying, if you don't have better roads, if you don't have the rail that allow BMW and Ford to function, to have the right electricity supply that makes the factories to work, to have the rail network that makes the goods to move. At the end of the day, we all losers in that. Mm. So I don't think as well private can say we're waiting for you as government to work. We have to all make things work. And I think we take responsibility that some of the things and they've not worked, and government is central to that, and government needs to pull its weight there. But the point is that we're all in this together. And that is why part of U20, there's also, for example, B20, which is business cooperation and discussion as part of the U20, because we all recognize that the solution lies with all of us.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Musa Khumalo, Chief Governance and Support Officer at the City of Tshwane.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo. You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, new research is warning that climate change could slash South Africa's food production by up to 50% by 2050. If that happens, we're not just facing rising prices. We're talking about hunger on a national scale. And I want to look at those numbers a little more closely and solutions from Stellenbosch Business School, Roscoe van Wyk. A very warm welcome to you. That figure hits you right between the eyes, a 50% drop in food production. Are we really grasping how catastrophic this might be, do you think?
The answer to the question is partially yes. The South African government have put in so many policies, especially climate-related policies and a new bill related to climate change. But I still think that, you know, within private sector as well as government, we can do more to mitigate effects of climate change and what looks to be a disaster in terms of how food security in our country is being projected.
So what more needs to be done then in that respect, Roscoe?
Well, I think that more collaboration needs to be done between government, private sector, as well as our citizens, our South African citizens, in terms of what they can do to assist smallholder farmers. Remember, we might be food secure at a national level in South Africa, but there are many regions in South Africa, specifically the rural regions in South Africa, that are, you know, suffering from food poverty, food insecurity. And I think that if we can assist the smallholder farmers within these regions through enterprise development, upskilling these farmers in terms of technology, infrastructure, invest a little bit more, not only in terms of finances, but also, you know, education, training, how do they use these smart agricultural technologies and innovations? I think we should focus on them to try and grow them and make them viable and sustainable at the same time, and therefore on a pathway to commercializing them so that they can even create more jobs. And, you know, within the rural sectors or in the rural regions of South Africa, I think agriculture plays a large role in job creation for these citizens.
We've got just over two decades to make a difference. Do we still have time?
Well, I always say I was part of a working group for climate change policy within the National Treasury a few years ago. And at that stage, that was in, I think, 2020, I think we said that we're 20 years too late in terms of generating policy. But when is the best time to start, Jeremy? It's right now. So in terms of climate, if you haven't started 20 years ago, you need to start immediately. And, you know, South Africa have very smart people in government, in private sector, with fantastic policies and strategies to mitigate climate change or the effects of climate change. But the implementation is sometimes the problem. I think we need to implement it more and implement these strategies more effectively, more efficiently. And not only that, we can't look at climate change and climate adaptation strategies and enterprise development separately for these smallholder farmers. They are the sort of custodians of food security, I think, within the regions that are food insecure, because they provide the availability of food within those regions in South Africa.
I hear you use the word strategies, and that might be the problem, if I'm hearing you correctly. Surely it's a better, clear, one-stop national strategy that links agriculture, climate adaptation, and enterprise development all under one roof.
I wouldn't just stop there, Jeremy. I think that that is great, right? We have to, I mean, policy in our country happens at a national level, but the intergovernmental relations needs to be strengthened as well in terms of not only looking at national government. I mean, I look at the droughts in the Western Cape not too long ago, and we sort of made it a national government issue. And I think that where we fail is that the intergovernmental strategies needs to be strengthened as well, where the provincial government needs to work alongside the national government and local government in terms of municipalities, where the implementation of these things happen. The problem is that the funding is made available. And I mean, there is funding available through donor partners, through reprioritization of the fiscus, all of those things. But does the money really get to where it's needed in terms of these smallholder farmers? And not only that, do we give them the education and the training and the know-how on how to actually, you know, move forward and provide this food basket for the poor in these regions?
And my sense would be is that we still don't have sufficient political will to shift agricultural subsidies towards the sustainability vision that you're talking about.
I think there is appetite, but I think it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of collaboration, not only with government and the departments within government, but with private sector as well. I think private sector can play a massive role in investment in the agri sector. In terms of, I know that government is responsible as their mandate for infrastructure, but you know, smart technology and other innovations, smart irrigation systems, climate resilient seeds and those things exist. But how do we capacitate these smallholder farmers and educate them on how to use them? You know, so it's not just the financial part. And by the way, sometimes the financial part doesn't reach those smallholder farmers anyway, but it's more the intangible things, the things that you learn. So I think that, mentorship programs from commercial farmers is very important. But at the same time, we need to incentivize these commercial farmers, Jeremy. There's no such thing as a free lunch. We all know that. And I think that with commercial farmers, if they do mentorship programs, and they do exist, but it needs to be more wide-scaled and be appropriate for specific smallholder farmers in different sectors. It can't be a blanket approach.
And just a final one, it's also ramping up investment, I imagine, in crop R&D, in weather technology, early warning systems and the like.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. That's so important. And I think that this is very important. We have so many successful local models and data and research and know-how within this country, you know, and with the right support, I think that these smallholder farmers can thrive. But it needs to be collectively. Like I said, it needs to be an approach where we use government, private sector, as well as communities in South Africa. I mean, communities can help by supporting and consuming from local markets or local food markets where these smallholder farmers trade and, you know, where they exist. And also the reduction of food waste and such things. I think investment and technology, those investments, you know, infrastructure investments, etc., needs to be a combination between government as well as private sector.
Roscoe van Wyk, thank you very much indeed from the Stellenbosch Business School. I appreciate your time.
Join the South African Guide Dog Association in the Give a Cane campaign running from the 5th of May to the 18th of July. Help us provide 1,000 white canes to visually impaired people by donating just 50 Rand. Your donation goes towards white canes and training, which helps our clients stay in touch with the world around them. Want to do more? Host your own fundraiser, get your book club, social group, school involved, or encourage your community to donate just 50 Rand. Be a part of someone's journey to freedom. Visit www.guidedog.org.za for more information.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's hosting of the G20 presidency comes with big ambitions and, I guess, bigger accountability. From cross-border tax cooperation to the war on illicit trade, the stakes couldn't be higher. At a recent progress briefing, the Foreign Relations Minister, Ronald Lamola, says we've entered a period of what he terms purposeful leadership. But the numbers, I think, tell a more complicated story. Illicit financial flows, smuggling and runaway tobacco trade draining the fiscus and are also undermining our financial action task force commitments. So what's the real state of reform, and are we getting serious or just getting by? Someone with a strong view on that is economist Sifiso Skanjana, and I want to unpack with him where policy is gaining traction and perhaps where it is falling apart. So Sifiso, welcome to you. And the minister talks of purposeful leadership, but with South Africa still grey-listed, isn't that just optimism covering for inaction?
I mean, I think just on the grey-listing, Jeremy, we did get feedback from the FATF simply on the action items that we needed to respond to last year. They came back in February this year again, With a view on some of the, I guess, items we had made progress on. And I think that really, I think, gave a sense for South Africa that we're probably at the next announcement, which is coming, I think, now, end of June, we're probably might see a revision of South Africa coming out of the grey list. But with that said, we are finding weaknesses in other parts of the issues that need, of course, to be dealt with from an illicit trade point of view. We, from a tobacco point of view, for example, South Africa is the only country in the world where an illicitly traded cigarette out-traded cigarettes that are traded over the counter. We're seeing that growing in terms of illicit alcohol sales as well, and we've seen a moderation, at least in illicit textiles. And so these are some of the issues that also then create a burgeoning environment for illicit money flows, as well as illicit industry product flows that I think could continue to put pressure in terms of where we are on the FATF perspective in terms of our grey listing. But as per the Feb note to us, however, it seemed like we were making some progress.
So let me pick you up on tobacco, if I can, and two quick issues here. One is that that figure of 60% of the market is astonishing. Does that mean that SARS itself is outgunned or underprepared? And also, the new tobacco bill itself completely ignores illicit trade. So it would be safe to say, surely, that it's toothless from the start.
Yeah, and I mean, I think starting with SARS' point of view, they're absolutely at this point in time undercapacitated to be able to respond to that. If you remember, there is a case that SARS did take to court where some of the manufacturers, in essence, to be honest with you, when SARS went in to do inspections in the factories, they dropped the cameras to look at the floor. And simply, I mean, and SARS took that to court, and the court found that the guys argued specifically that this would hamper their competitive positioning. And so I think there's certainly some rethinking around some of the work that happens there. But I think from an SABS point of view, which is in essence the standards, we've seen Kenya make really, really interesting progress there in terms of track and trace. And so all the way from the paper that's used in the cigarette, etc., each of them has got a serial number. And I think that then ultimately enhances the ability to track and trace and therefore to be able to follow the money from a revenue point of view. And I mean, we know that from a tobacco point of view, we're now losing close to about 20 billion in terms of fiscal leakage just on the back end of that. And so I think capacitation from a SARS point of view is a massive, massive agenda, as well as I think in terms of the value chain, which then goes to the standards and specifications. And I think then looking specifically at the tobacco bill, I think one of the things that is a challenge is when you're looking at issues with sin goods, as we often call them, is that public health promotion becomes the beat and end all. And sometimes the overemphasis on public health promotion can create a blind spot in the way in which we need to think about all the other things that are moving parts in the sector. And so when you look at particularly some of them, the provisions that are ignored insofar as the bill is concerned, is if South Africa really then is, you know, in a melting pot for illicit trade, surely then we must understand that, you know, the bill must address those things. And I think the bill is wholly failed to address issues that can lead to illicit trading in South Africa. And I think that's one of the things that I think is going to be a big pressure point when the bill, or if the bill does get pushed through.
And there's also a revenue paradigm to all of this. So you suggest that we've passed the LAFA curve peak, but the response is we keep hiking excise taxes. So surely it's an indication either of revenue blindness, just not understanding the issue, or just political posturing.
No, I think it's definitely both, right? Then the posturing is simply that, you know, if it's a sin good, you must tax it forever and ever. You know, that's kind of the thinking, that it's the one thing you always expect, without looking at the industry and market dynamics of that particular sector, looking at whether or not you're going to run the sector to the ground through more excessive taxing, or looking at alternative models of actually one getting value out of the industry. Because as you said, once you've passed the LAFA curve, any additional percentage in taxation actually results in negative growth outcomes in that particular sector. And so certainly I think when we look at that particular sector, we've missed opportunities of looking comprehensively of in essence, what I would call the smoking economy. When you look at, you know, kind of the growth in vaping, and then there's non-burn products, heat-not-burn products. You've got the products that you put underneath your tongue, etc. And therefore, when you're thinking about taxation, differentiation becomes quite important. And so once you start to say the extent to which the product creates a certain risk, the level of taxation must be commensurate to that. And therefore, when you look at Article 14 coming from the World Health Organization talking about cessation, which simply speaks about then trying to move people to smoking less, and therefore your tax regime must be responsive to a cessation program. And so when people are moving to heat not burn products, and so people aren't exposed to secondary smoke, that must expose itself to a different taxation regime. And so all this is the kind of thinking, innovative thinking, that we need to be thinking about at a national treasury level when we are now starting to think about a dynamic and a changing industry. It's no longer just cigars and cigarettes. It's moving into different types of parts of the industry. And I think those are some of the things that could improve some of the revenue collection outcomes at a national treasury level.
I'll just need a quick answer to this because time's against us. You suggest that we're at something of a tipping point. So are we there yet? And what's the real economic cost of the country if we don't act right now?
Massive economic cost, I think, is that 60% of the illicit market's going to get higher. And then it means that all your efforts to curb negative health outcomes from cigarettes are actually going to be moot. And I think that's the first big issue, is that everything around public health promotion is actually going to regress. Secondly, the revenue that you're going to be able to collect from the sector is going to regress as well. And so we're at a tipping point in terms of public health promotion as well as future revenue collection from the sector.
Well, the warning certainly has been sounded. That's economist Sifiso Skanjana. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, on paper, I guess, being your own boss sounds great until the tax season rolls around. And for sole proprietors, the freedom of running a business comes with serious tax responsibilities, from deductions and VAT to PAYE and provisional returns. The rules are strict and the penalties often are unforgiving. So what are the do's and don'ts? It's worth taking a quick refresher on this. And I'm in conversation now from FNB Commercial with Rorisang Mopi. Rorisang, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. So let's get real. How many sole proprietors, in your opinion, are maybe non-compliant and they don't even know it?
So, Jeremy, if you think about just how customers tend to sometimes just take it for granted, right, that if you are really a business and you're taking yourself seriously, it's when you've actually registered for CIPC. So I'd argue there's quite a lot of sole proprietors that are running businesses and are definitely non-compliant from a tax perspective, purely just from that assumption that you really are a true business and should be registering for tax as a business if you have registered CIPC.
Part of the problem, I understand, is that many small business owners would confuse personal and business income. And that's a big risk, isn't it, for an audit?
No, it's definitely a big risk. I mean, if you're not necessarily splitting your activity from a personal and business perspective from day one, it then becomes very difficult even to prove to SARS how much you've actually earned for the business, how much of that should have actually been recognized as personal, and I guess splitting it in a manner in which it becomes clear what is business and what is personal.
There seems as well to be very little awareness around provisional tax and IRP 6 filings. Do you think that's just the fault of the business owner, or does SARS need to be doing more to explain the paradigm and to educate?
So I think the responsibility lies with both parties. The challenge that you have if you talk to a lot of small business owners is they tend to see SARS as this big scary entity, right? And by virtue of that, you are already not going to take the effort to try and understand what you need to do in terms of compliance from a tax perspective. So I think the onus does lie with both parties, but definitely I'd say our revenue services definitely does need to do better, right, in terms of just educating our customers to make sure they are aware what those requirements are before they actually caught on the wrong side of the law.
And what are the rules regarding VAT registration, which we know can be very complex sometimes and very costly?
So from a VAT perspective, there's an option to either register from a voluntary perspective, or given how much your taxable supplies, and by taxable supplies, we're talking about items that you are either selling or services that you render that are then subject to VAT. So from a voluntary perspective, if your services or the goods that you're selling that are subject to VAT in terms of the VAT Act are above 50,000, you can then choose to voluntarily register for VAT. But the business owner needs to also just be wary that it also comes with a significant administrative burden of submitting these returns to the SARB every month or every 2 months, depending on the VAT category that the customer would have then elected. But from a compulsory perspective, as soon as you've actually exceeded 1 million in terms of taxable supplies, you are then in a position where VAT registration then becomes compulsory.
Let's move away from VAT. Are there common deductions that small businesses often forget to claim? Because I'm assuming if they do, that's going to be of a cost to them.
No, definitely. I think from an overriding theme perspective, the easy way to identify whether something is deductible or not is whether it was actually incurred as a cost for the purposes of the business. So these include business-related rent, office supplies, advertising and salaries, which are like the common ones, right? But ones where, I mean, if you think about the fact that we are now living in a hybrid world where some people are actually even working in their homes, home office expenses are ones that can also be deducted if you have a dedicated space for business. And internet and phone bills also tend to get forgotten, but only the portion, again, that is used for business. And you will then also need to be able to keep a record of these so that you can prove to SARS, you know, that you these is what that you have incurred from a business perspective.
Now let's move on to hiring your first employee. And that, I imagine, also comes with a stack of compliance. So I'm thinking PAYE, UIF. As the system stands at the moment, do you think it's too cumbersome? Do you think it's too bureaucratic for small businesses?
It's quite a tough one, to be honest. And I think that's probably why the best approach for small businesses, for you to be properly set up from a SARS perspective, is to engage with a professional to take you through this. And it doesn't even have to be an ongoing expense that you pay. It can be something that is set up from the get-go, and they do it once and set you up and you're ready to run on a monthly basis. But yes, there's definitely expectations if you do have employees in terms of them being registered for PAYE, which is pay as you earn, where that tax would also have to be deducted from their salaries and paid over to SARS with a monthly return. In addition to that, there's also UIF and SDL, which is Skills Development Levy, depending obviously on where you are in terms of your payroll costs, which I wouldn't anticipate you'd have to pay with your first employee. But the moment you start ramping up on staff, this are the other items that would then kick in.
Do you think the current tax system favors large companies with big accounting teams over smaller, leaner entrepreneurs?
So I'd say the way the system from a SARS perspective is set up, it definitely is a little bit more lenient to the smaller businesses, enabling, you know, them and to give them a chance to not have a huge tax bill, to be honest, compared to your bigger corporates that do it then exist.
That's a very good primer. Thank you so much for joining us. That is Rorisang Mope from FNB Commercial. I appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.